Welcome to Hi Bob, the officially unofficial For All Mankind podcast on Apple TV Plus. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking season 3, episode 3, All In. Aaron, how in are you on this show?
I'm all the way in, baby.
Nice.
I'm going through the gulags for the show. I don't care how many people get strangled right in front of me.
You and Margo. Yep.
I love this episode because I think we both felt a little shortchanged, like, oh, I don't know about this Sergey and Margo thing. But I thought the cold open did a lot to kind of alleviate and kind of like illustrate how this has kind of gone, you know, that like Sergey has been left to play the patient game. And now that the screws are in him and the fire's to his feet, the Russians are forcing his hand. And, you know, I thought that was handled really well. Mm-hmm. I like the ascension of Aleta at NASA.
Yeah.
I don't like the Danny shit, but it's interesting. And it's Ed doing very Ed things.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
I love the scene of Kelly standing up to Ed and telling her she's true blue for NASA. Like, I just thought there was a lot to like about this episode. And mm-hmm. I love the way they handled the time jump. Like, yeah. I was wondering, like, okay, what's going to... I'm interested in seeing this kind of like Robert Zubrin's A Case for Mars brought to life type of stuff. But like, isn't this going to feel really samey for like the season one people, like, oh, getting to see all the astronaut candidate qualifications and all the testing and all that kind of stuff? Won't that feel like a retread? And they're just like, fuck all that shit. We're going to. And the nature of a Mars mission where these optimum launch windows open up every few years compresses everyone's mission into the same 2-week time, and it's just a brilliant setup for a space race. I love it. What about you?
Yeah, you have almost a legitimate race, right, where they fire the gun and everybody's off at the same time, and now it's just about who can get there first, and or at all, you know, it's no guarantee that anybody's making it there. So I mean, look, I've seen the trailer. I know somebody makes it there. I've seen a boot on the ground at the end of season two. But
in 1995, so we know it's happening.
Yeah. That's the thing. So we are jumping ahead a lot of years. This episode spans 10 years, right? 1984 with Margo and Sergey starting their relationship at the IAC conference, all the way to 1994 when we launched the missions to Mars. I was very impressed with how seamless that all felt. Same as you said. I love some of the emotional stuff going on here. Like, one of the standout scenes in season two was Kelly telling Ed that she's not going to the Naval Academy, right? And that was just like crushing to Ed. And Ed, like, it was kind of scary in the moment what he was going to do. And they roll that back here in a way that is like so smart as a storyteller. Because you're then in that mindset again of like when Kelly tells him, look, I'm going to NASA, not to Helios. You're like, oh God, there's another opportunity for Ed to freak out. And he plays it like that, right? Like, he's very disappointed and his face turns sour. He stands up, gives her the hug, and you're like, oh man, Ed, you've changed, right? You've gotten it. And it's such a good moment for that entire family there.
And it's funny because it's like, the same. So he's learned a lot of lessons in his life and he's made a lot of self-improvement. But a lot of those lessons that I think he learned with Gordon in season two are the wrong lessons. Uh-huh. And he is so confident in the like, all this boy needs is to get back into space. He needs an objective. He needs a mission. He just can't hear Danielle Poole's very reasonable and reality based quibbles with Danny's performance in the space program. But you can see why he thinks that.
Mm-hmm. It worked for Gordo. Like, it totally worked last season. He got Gordo,
and he probably shouldn't have. Like, I remember horse. Like, that was the thing I was thinking, like, you can't like just will yourself over like mental trauma. The thing is you I guess you can, like, with the right set of motivation, the right person in the right circumstances, can kind of like just through fucking effort and will and drive override some of those things. But it's pretty exceptional.
The scary part of that is, like, we don't get to see that long term with Cordo, right? He makes a sacrifice while he's up there. We don't get to see if that lasts or if that even devastates him even further, right? So
yes,
it's a dangerous game.
And maybe that's the show telling that, like, you know, that worked out for Gort. But did it work out? Because they end up both dying on the surface of the moon.
Right.
What is Danny going to look like, you know, not being able to take this moment? Because it felt like the consequences were he was going to hit rock bottom and he was going to be honest with his wife and he was going to try to rebuild his life. Mm-hmm. But there's just so many, from the NASA's clandestine way to sweep all this stuff under the rug to Ed when in his mission commander said, nope, you're going to experience consequences, just making all those go away. Like, we just recently saw this with We Own the City, right? Where this cop is well on his way to being absolute corrupt shitbag of shitbags, gets called in the carpet, and then finds out he's scared, like, oh my god, this is going to fuck up my whole life. And then he finds out there's no consequences. I feel like Danny's in a really dangerous place where he thought the world worked a certain way and now he's seeing that it doesn't. And what's this going to look like when you've got this guy who's several screws loose in his main assembly? What's it going to look like under the pressure cooker of a Mars situation?
Yeah. Oh, there's a lot going on there. We haven't even talked about the, you know, cheating element with Karen and how that's all going to factor into it. That's a whole nother can of worms. That's a very complicated situation. I'm eager to see the resolution to.
Yeah, like it's like Oedipus with a twist. What's going on with him and Ed?
Oedipus? Yeah. The other thing that's really interesting me here is is it Daniel Iessa? Is it another fucking Daniel?
It's Dev.
Dev. Iessa. Okay. He continues to confound my expectations for him. Scene where he agrees to retool the entire cockpit and command structure of this thing just because Ed isn't happy with it is wild to me. And I don't know if it's wild and like, oh, I don't believe it. This is a character that's gone, you know, wrong in the writing process, or if this is just a character I'm not used to seeing. Or a side of a person that I'm not used to seeing, or a person I don't think exists. I don't know.
Because it makes you wonder, like, what is the things in his life that he won't flex on?
Right.
You know, if he'll throw out we've got a short list of commanders. Oh, Ed Baldwin's there. Because like they perfectly set up that, like, we knew Ed was going to go apeshit when he found out that this was going to be a Maytag man, fully automated mission. And he knew he was going to say all those things. And when he did, like, and he's like, I was fully ready to, like, oh my God, he's going to throw Ed off of this mission. And what's that going to look like? And he just completely 180'd on it. Yeah, I don't. But there's got to be at some point he's going to get fed up with all these compromises of his vision because he wants a poet on Mars.
Right.
I don't even know if that's a terrible idea. If you got like 24 people, put one artist poet that can, you know, spark the human imagination to be there to kind of like chronicle it. Like a bard of the party, you know, that's going to give them +5 so all their will saves and constitution checks. I don't know. Like, maybe you haven't thought this through, Ed. Have you thought about the bard angle?
I mean, that's probably going to be a bit of the compromise, right? Like, okay, we are going to send the bard with you, but we're also going to retool everything. So you are in command. You can control the ship if you need to.
Yes.
And I think Ed will take that deal, certainly. But yeah, continues to confound my expectations. We'll see if that stays true or if that changes over the course of the season. I mean, that's the big one. I definitely have questions about what you think is going on with Margot and the Russians or the Soviets, but we'll get there. We can talk about that in situ in this episode. I think it's about time we got over to the recap. What do you think?
All systems go. Ready for main recap insertion burn.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
All right, we start off with Margot and Sergei bonding over the years, from 1984 to 1991 at the various IAC conventions that happen. It culminates in them almost hooking up, but their flirting is interrupted and Margot decides not to go through with it. 7 years of flirting, man, that is hard to get. That is...
Slowest of burns, yes. The bluest of balls.
Yep.
It is, but it's like, you know, it's like this really slow motion. Will they, won't they? I thought it was fun to see them age in real time.
Yeah.
You know, quote,
yeah.
Unquote.
Her hair just that gets shorter, really cool. And shorter and shorter.
Yeah. And his hair gets goner and goner and, you know, making it up with facial hair. That's a move you can make. I've heard other successful men have made that transition.
Sure. Some of them, you know, yeah.
Just transition to hair on the top to the bottom. And there's like all the things that kind of like, you know, maybe he makes the move in 1985, but, oh, she mentions she has to get up early, so mm-hmm. I can't do it then. And maybe like the way their ships just keep passing on the night, like it looks like something's going to happen in 91. They're holding hands and then one of their, it seems like maybe either Chinese or Japanese compatriots, or hell, maybe he just works for the EU or America. I don't fucking know. Like, gets on right as they're approaching, so they would be seen getting off at the same. It's everything just kind of keeps getting in the way.
And I love just like how hard of a target here Margot is. You know, like I'm picturing Bill in her position if some attractive scientist was trying to seduce him in order to get information. I mean, it would have worked first night of the first convention, 1984. They'd have nuclear drive technology, right? It would just happen,
right?
But Margot, she's cautious in everything, and I think that's part of what makes her a good mission control administrator. I what is the name? Mission controller, I think, is just
launch
what they're,
flight director.
Called. Flight director, yes.
Official, yeah.
That's part of what makes her very good at her job, and it's boy, taking down these walls. For Sergei is quite the job. It's a job of a lifetime, pretty much.
And I think it goes both ways because, like, up until the hotel scene room, I was like, does Sergei have any game whatsoever? Like, it really feels like he doesn't. Yeah. He's like a, you know, Jack Lemmon when it comes to closing. He just can't get it done, man. No matter how many steak knives are up for grabs. But once he does get underway, it seemed like he was going somewhere. But it's like, it's the other thing is like this. Watching this a second time, which I did this morning when I was taking my notes and getting all my thoughts together, this plays almost incredibly sadly. It feels like, because there's the element of that spring trap slowly closing in, and without, I think, either of them knowing it. Although I guess Sergei did from he knew that the Russian state had ideas for Margot.
Oh, yeah. They come to him
and was
last
collecting
year.
Kompromat. Yeah. Yeah.
Last season. That's the thing. I can imagine, like, what do the Soviets say when he comes back from the IAC and they're like, report on your progress. And he tells him, yeah, I flirted a little bit. It didn't go anywhere. Uh-huh. I missed her in the elevator. Just, you know, she had to get up early.
I brushed fingertips with her there, comrade.
Right. What's the thing? Like, describe it. And he describes, like, I gave her a look. They're like,
yeah.
And...
It was significant. Like, it was over sushi. You don't understand.
Right. And then the next year, he comes back and does it again. 7 years is a long time, but we'll see.
But
it
he is. That's
smart.
The thing is, like, I guess he is what we're not seeing. And I wish kind of we did. Like, I wish I understood the scope, of their cooperation. Mm-hmm. Because it seems like they had one rule, which is no military applications. It's like, you know, something to kind of help in the life and safety of the crew and the cosmonauts, things like that. But nothing military.
Yeah.
But I kind of wish I had a context, but I guess I don't need it. You know, they mentioned some stuff that they'd helped on, like, you know, throttle valves and things like that. And we know she helped him avoid 7 probably cosmonauts exploding because of their solid booster rocket problem that they ended up fixing in this timeline.
Yeah. So they have been exchanging info. It's just they not have the stuff that they really want.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, then we go to Margot. It's 1991 again. 1992 again?
92. 92, yep.
Margot decides that NASA is going to launch their Mars mission in 1994, just like Helios, and just like the Soviets, as we'll see here in a bit. Her team seems to think it's doable, though not ideal. Bill's the voice of dissent because this pre-supply mission they have, like if you've seen The Martian, this is all the stuff they need once they get there. It's not going to be ready in time, but Elaida comes up with this idea to use a slingshot maneuver to get the mission launched outside of the window they thought they had. Basically, it lets them fire a rocket into a different trajectory that will get it there on time.
It's like, you know, when Google Maps tells you can take the country roads and get there in an hour, or you could take the interstate, even though it's technically a couple miles longer, but you're going to get there in 45 minutes.
Yeah.
It's the same like Venus. If you know, you're my very energetic mother just served us nine. She serves us nine because the pickles got voted off the solar system. Venus is in the opposite direction of Mars. But in certain alignments, you can, you know, swing past that big gravitational booty, get a boost off of it and get there faster, even though you're traveling longer in space. Yeah. Also, this I was excited because like this is essentially the Robert Zubrin plan. This is if you've read his book, A Case for Mars, and if you're a space fan, I highly recommend it. It's almost as readable as The Martian. It's not that exciting, but it's very conversational, and he outlines the technology. The idea is you are going to send automated science lab type experiments. So you're going to land the HAB, you're going to land the rovers, and you're going to land various science lab that's going to convert raw materials on Mars, specifically carbon dioxide and water vapor, into methane for return rockets, to drinkable water, and a variety of other things that this. So all you're sending with the crew capsule is essentially the clothes on their back and the food and other supplies that they need just to survive the trip there. Everything else, and the brilliant part of that plan is you can observe all this, and you know how many gallons of water you got. You don't have to launch until the astronauts have everything there. Everything's past set. So all you got to do is get them to Mars.
Well, that's risky.
The approach that Zubrin decried, which was the popular thing in the mid-90s of NASA, was what he called the Battlestar Galactica plan, which is what we see Helios doing, which is a massive starship with everything you need to get there, to survive the trip, to get there, and to perhaps come back. And you see the difference at the end of this episode. Mm-hmm. NASA's launching what looks like a skiff, and Phoenix is this massive fucking thing. It's a space station with half again as much tonnage to just get it there. So the only difference is the Zubrin has also decried going to the moon as a way station, because he's like, that's kind of a waste of time. And you know, it's actually more delta V to get to the moon and then to Mars than to launch from a low Earth orbit. But, you know, he was also writing this book in the 90s where we didn't have a moon base. If you had a moon base developed, you probably was a lot that. So, like, I was thrilled to see all these different approaches. And I think there was one other thing, which is the one big rocket approach, which it looks like the Russians are doing.
Oh, are they?
Okay. Where they're just one massive rocket lifting everything they need into a single stage to orbit and then head. So it's cool seeing all three of these approaches as Zubrin laid out in the 90s coming to life on this television show. And if you want spoilers probably for the season, check out A Case for Mars.
Yeah, someone over there is a fan, I'm sure.
I guess they've updated. I was looking on Amazon. He updated it in 2011. I kind of want to get that and read it again, because it's if you're excited about Mars colonization, it's a great book to read.
All right. Like I said, the Soviet Union follows suit to launch in 1994. And we see Ellen on television debating Bill Clinton on the issue. She is pro moving up the timeline. Clinton, I think, is against it. And it makes sense that she would be pro NASA, right? She has faith in these people. She worked with them.
Yeah, and I thought some, like, you know, obviously he's having words put in his mouth, literally. But it's like, it's a weak defense of robbing money from the space budget, especially in this timeline where NASA's contributing more to the national budget than they're getting in funding because of all the technological boosts. And, you know, it's just like, yeah, in a world where like NASA is essentially solving the climate crisis with their technology, hard to say that they shouldn't get funded, even on something as boondoggly as a trip to Mars.
I will say, as a little behind the scenes sort of thing here, we have screener copies of this, and putting words in Bill Clinton's mouth, I thought didn't work out so well. But then I noticed, and I'm glad they did this because it wasn't lining up with his mouth.
Right.
And in the corner, they put temporary visual effects. So they let me know. Sometimes I get that on the screeners. Sometimes I don't.
They haven't completely deep faked them. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So I was very appreciative that they told me that. Otherwise, I would be here complaining like, oh, that. What a piss poor job they did on that, but no, it's fine.
Yeah, we have to. I think it's at some point start to be aware because like it's happened to us enough times. Like you're gonna have to. I don't know how much they'd appreciate us back. Yeah. So, but it's also nice that they'd actually say that these are unfinished effects,
right? Yeah. All right. Helios has converted Karen's Polaris Hotel into the Phoenix, and Dias is giving Ed a tour. Ed's impressed by the mobile hab solution. Karen's a little traumatized by the events as they walk past the elevator where Sam died.
The first time I saw it, it's like, wouldn't it be funny if they're like still cutting Sam out of the wreckage? They're walking by, there's this desiccated corpse. Uh-huh. And, you know.
So Ed is extra impressed when they show him the updated technology and honestly the spaciousness of the Phoenix's cockpit. Iessa asks who Ed wants on his team, and he says, oh, he's got a long list, 3 pilots, 2 engineers, navigator, all with experience. And Iessa's like, well, this thing is automatically controlled, so you don't even need a flight crew, you just need you, and you're not going to have any control, it's just going to milk run you there. Ed is not happy about that, or that, you know, Iessa wants to fill the extra slots, the would-be flight crew, with poets and artists and stuff like that. Definitely not happy about all of that. And he tells Iessa so. And the dude just says, all right, I'll change everything about the architecture of this room, about our systems. You can have control. Wild.
Yeah. There's some exciting things. He mentions these mobile hab units. I think if I tracked the conversation that they've replaced the hotel rooms that kind of ring the ring with these, what he described as mobile hab units. I think they're going to be like RVs that can independently land on the Mars surface and then like scoot around, like use thrusters to kind of go. And he's explaining that like, what they're going to make up for, and probably NASA's probably got more intelligence about where stuff is because of their previous exploratory missions and their satellites and all that kind of stuff. We're going to, and also we're not going to have all the stuff we need, it sounds like, but you're going to have the ability that once you get there, you can fly wherever you want to take advantage of the opportunities on the ground.
Well, that seemed really cool. I don't know exactly if I have enough information about their plan. Do they do a pre-mission to load stuff onto Mars? I think they're just going all at once.
That's why they have the fucking Ark, you know, the Noah's Ark in space. It's just so big that they're going to take everything they need. But it sounds like even then they don't have everything they need, because else why would they care about water?
Yeah. So are they sending a post-landing mission to like say, well, we're gonna supply you with enough water and stuff to live up there until we can get a mission to you with the machines to make it? Or
no, I think they're counting on finding water on Mars. They just don't know where it's at. And then like NASA had to bet everything on Jonestown being that, you know, because they didn't. Whereas this thing's gonna be
not
mobile.
Jonestown. Although I can see.
I keep on calling it Jonestown, probably because I'm sitting here across from Jim Jones, but it's Jamestown, not Jonestown. I think I did that a bunch in the first 2 podcasts. I think that you just kind of have the flexibility to fly potentially halfway across the planet to wherever the water is. Or the other thing is, like, I wonder if they'll claim jump, kind of like the way the Russians did, except for they can kind of just roll up with like 6 different habs and, you know.
Yeah, we'll just borrow this, you know, and then pay the fines or whatever that come along with that. Sure. That could be interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, especially since I feel like this episode and throughout the other episodes, it's been a friendly rivalry.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, oh, you know, Kelly's like, oh, you watch out, old man, I'm coming after you. And Danny's like, oh, I'm going to gimp your knee and you're going to be sorry. And even, you know, Margot and Sergey kind of, that's going to turn into cutthroat competition as they get closer to Mars.
It's life or death up there, right? It's not on Earth. Yeah. Like everybody can be happy and share things on Earth, but up there, if there's only enough water for one team and you have 3 teams, one team is going to get that water.
the Belters in the Expanse would say that's the opposite way to look at it. You should, like, as life is more critical, you should work closer together. But we've seen how things went on to Mars.
Right.
Now you already have the Russians talking about capitalist swine can't take over the... I think it's going to be, and there's also going to be, like, I could see NASA getting there first, but in a very Spartan way. Mm-hmm. And then they have, you know, Dev AS's Phoenix crew just flying in their RVs with Wolfgang Puck MREs and taking advantage of all their and like living it up, essentially. And what kind of stresses. And then God knows what the condition the Soviets will get there.
And you asked earlier, you know, what is the hard line that ISO won't compromise on, right? And he does have an ethos, an idea, philosophy of colonization of Mars, right? He professed it to Karen last episode. He basically said, look, I want to get there so it won't be this squabble over territory, this war that erupts on Mars because the US and the Soviets can't get along. Does he at some point draw that hard line and get involved in some kind of war to, you know, a war to keep war from breaking out on Mars, right? Like,
exactly.
It's so obviously, like, wrongheaded, but I could see someone with a deeply held belief like that getting involved in ways that they didn't expect.
Yeah, it's like, it's kind of shades of like the Vietnam era. We had to destroy the village to save the village, you know, right. Like to protect the open frontier of Mars. We have to assault the open frontier of Mars.
Yeah.
And also, like, we saw what kind of shit show this happened in the first season or two. Are they gonna take weapons to Mars? Surely the Americans and Soviets will.
Yes. Yeah.
And Dev, as a smart guy, you'd think he would know that.
And I think if the Soviets and the Americans were launching in 96 like they had planned, he might not take them, but...
Right, because he would have uncontested skies.
Right, but now he'd kind of be a fool not to.
You would, because like I said, everyone said they weren't going to on the moon,
mm-hmm.
then they did. Now, I don't know if there's been a follow-on peace treaty where they've, like, you know, because they divvied up the moon and they divvied up the American continents and all that kind of stuff. I wonder if there's something. But on the other hand, like, what keeps them from breaking it? And also, I noticed that the mm-hmm. Chinese weren't ever a mention. I wonder if that will be a wild card later on, that, like, maybe Russian and Americans can learn to play nice, but the Chinese are the ones going to bring... But I don't know. Like I said, it was America that militarized the moon first, it turns out, in mm-hmm. the first two seasons. We'll see.
Yeah. All right, Daniel and Danny, the double Dans here, simulate their Mars landing and they crash, mostly because Danny's distracted by something, which he claims is that Amber will, you know, is buying a house and he's getting deeper in this relationship. But actually, there is a lot more on his mind.
Oh, God, this guy's mind is just a fucking kaleidoscope of noise. And
yeah, especially he sees a statue of his parents, right? Mm.
Any one thing, being in a marriage that you're not sure about, and it's happening so fast, like, oh, we're getting to a house, and oh, we're gonna have kids, and you later get a better idea of who Amber is, and she kind of wants to mm-hmm. be this 50s housewife. But and then he's got, like, I like that scene of him walking out past the picture of Gordo and Trace, and you know, like, that kind of that's like you losing your parents, but also, like, such a huge set of shoes to fill when it comes to space travel and space flight. You know, like, they're literal national heroes.
Yeah. Karen tells Aleta later this episode, right? Do you want to be Margo's girl forever?
Right.
He feels like he's Gordo's boy, right? Like, there's
probably nothing he can ever do other than maybe be the second man on Mars that would ever even begin to offset the things that his parents has done. So there's just a lot going on. And then, he's also got this Oedipus complex with Ed and Karen.
Mm-hmm.
But I like how Danielle Poole plays this as just very concerned with Danny the man, you know, like, I'm worried about you. And instead of, like, putting his feet to the fire, she's like, why don't you take the day off and go home to your new wife and relax a little bit, which doesn't work because he doesn't take the advice.
Right. No, I really like Danielle. She seems the most with it in all ways, right? I mean, she's a great commander. She mm-hmm. is really in tune with people's emotions and where they are and their state of minds. And she gives them the space to deal with that stuff, or wants to at least. She seems great all around. And then it's just outside forces keep stymieing her.
Agreed.
All right. Kelly is welcomed at NASA by Danielle. And she asks Danielle if she can go to Mars with the NASA mission rather than the Helios mission for several reasons. She doesn't want to be on a mission with her father. And she also likes the science angle of the NASA missions. So she manages to talk Danielle into it by claiming that her research makes her the best person for the job of, I guess, finding the first signs of extraterrestrial life.
Yeah, Antarctica is actually a pretty good analog for Mars in terms of its dryness, in terms of its cold, and in terms of its relatively barren lifelessness. And it makes me wonder, because we're like, why did she get sidelined in Antarctica if she's brand new at NASA and like she apparently had gone into space? And it feels like this is a really savvy play that she's like, you know what? I can keep doing stuff and be well short of the seniority required to get on that first flight, or I can stay on Earth and like craft this specific niche of finding life in the lifeless place on Earth and demonstrating competence at it, so I can roll into somebody's office in a couple of years and be like, I'm doing the mission that you are at. And it works.
Yeah, I have to imagine a lot of the other people in her field are probably not trained astronauts, right?
Right. And the ones that are, like she says, are going to be like generic botanists, anybody can Mark Watney. Anybody can grow potatoes in a shit bucket. But I have expertise, maybe the only one that's space qualified in the whole world, of finding these light, and that's what's going to make the mission. And I wonder what kind of artistic license Ronald Moore feels about making a stand on whether Mars has life on it or not.
I don't know. I guess we'll see.
Yeah. Because like that would be a huge fork in the road if they find some kind of microbial life or something on Mars. And I could see that having like crazy, crazy implications for not just philosophically and, you know, otherwise, but like, you know, in terms of genetics and in terms of like life here on Earth.
Sure. All right. We go over to Danny drinking at the outpost when a woman at the bar flirts with him, and then he sees Karen walk in and decides he's going to leave with this woman.
I had hope that seeing Karen would scare him straight, like, no. I need to get, but now it sends him further into the danger zone.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like he's trying to fulfill desires through proxies here. It's not going to work, Danny. Come on.
No. There's a Karen, for whatever fucking reason, kid, there's a Karen-shaped hole in your heart and pelvis, and it's funny because, like, I felt like, I'll wait to talk about that in another scene. I did like the fact that here in the mid-90s, a girl's picking up a dashing astronaut, buying him drinks, and that's a very unusual thing, and it's chalked up to, like, equal rights, baby.
Yeah. That is a good line. All right, Karen is also at the outpost here, obviously. She asks Aleta to leave NASA and join Helios, and she tries to tempt her with more money, better benefits, and stock options. She also claims, look, there's less hierarchical bullshit over at Helios too. Unfortunately for Karen, Aleta is too loyal to Margot to accept the offer for basically making her career, you know, and not even just her career, but her life in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's another one where she kind of echoes what Kelly says. There is something about working for NASA that probably I'm talking our times, and another generation or two is going to be just a little bit more prestigious and a little bit more, I don't know, like it's got the cloak of nationalism and patriotism and like working for your country and being selfless. And the fact that she goes on and later in the episode that she comes from dirt poverty in Mexico, and all these things like is kind of like a miraculous thing that she's surrounded. And yes, she has to work hard and maybe she's not appreciated, but she got to go to the fucking moon, and that where she plopped at the moon rock and be like, Margot's faith in me is not just a one time thing and a one time investment. She fights for me and all these other things. And, yeah. Because the reason, you know, she could work in Helios till the cows go home. She'd probably never go to Mars, never go to the moon. But she was able to. Like I said, I think that loyalty is a little bit foolhardy and misplaced. But I'm not a 30-something Mexican immigrant that set foot on the moon.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Came from basically nothing. Yeah. It's I don't know. Like, I'm interested to see where this goes. I think. Yeah. As far as like the reputation of NASA in our future, I think like as I think the mask is slipping from the face of corporations. Right. And as the reputation of corporations takes more and more of a hit, NASA's reputation has nowhere to go but up. And I think, yeah, you could see it being more, far less lucrative. It's always going to be more lucrative to work for a private organization, almost certainly. But, you know, as far as the respect you get for doing what you do, NASA could become an institution that is very well respected universally, above anything like a SpaceX or Dick Ship thing.
Well, I mean, the only reason like SpaceX and these guys are getting as much buzz as they're doing is because NASA's essentially stepped back from human spaceflight.
Right.
Like,
right.
They've made it clear. I mean, I know that they make rumblings about going back to the moon and doing a Mars mission, but they've been saying that ever since George H.W. Bush, that they're going to, and like, I'm a little jaded about that, but like private money, the hell, they might get it done. In this retro alternate pass where NASA never has continued to pioneer and has an ongoing enterprise on the moon, like, I imagine it's a lot more attractive to take that pay cut and work for the hard chargers with the big budgets and the nation behind them than it is some kind of tech upstart.
Yeah. Yeah, I would think so. Here's the thing. I'm not sure that it's more prestigious or easier to do. Is it really easier to work in this bar than it is at her house? Like, I know there's chaos going on at her house with the kid and her two dads, but like, really in a bar? I don't know.
Her kid seems pretty disruptive, and her dad seems pretty disruptive. And I mean, that's the thing about this play is I'm all for it, but like, clearly Victor has misgivings. You wonder if, Leda's going to have to sacrifice family to some extent, to maintain this kind of altruism she's got, the True Blue NASA thing. Because, man, her dad, I've been saying it from the jump, but this episode puts it right there, point blank center, and we got a 2-year time jump. That shit doesn't usually get better over time. Mm-hmm. So she's having ever more responsibilities at NASA, ever more time commitments, and she's leaving her husband there to babysit one and a half kid.
Yeah. So Danny and the woman that he left the bar with are trying to have sex in a pool, but Danny drops his ring in and he's got to dive down after it. And when he surfaces, the cops are there busting him for swimming in somebody else's pool. It's not his pool anymore. This is his parents' old house, by the way.
I recognize this pool from scuba diving to bottom. Like, I thought they just talked about him getting a new house. I'm like, well, maybe his brother lives there. And then when the lights go on underwater, oh yeah, this is what's going to happen.
The cop realizes he's gonna arrest him, but he realizes that he's Gordo's son and decides not to. And here is where, I think part of what's annoying Danny is those big shoes to fill. Like you said, he's just seen as Gordo's boy, the kid of the hero.
And like the fact that he's maybe you didn't know this before, but it turns out the local cops have like a longstanding agreement with NASA to kind of like sweep all this bullshit under. These hard drinking, hard charging test pilots that, like to fuck women that aren't their wives, but have the they got a whole system set up to maintain that behavior and excuse it. It's enabling is what it is.
Yeah. And I like this next scene with Danielle because she's not a part of that. Right. She's like the tail end of what I think is that system.
If Ed picks him up here, there's absolutely no consequences whatsoever. But Danielle, as the mission commander, is, even though there's not, I'm going to inflict consequences on you. You're taking yourself off of flight ready status and having to work your way back before you get onto the Mars trip.
But I'm not saying anything to anybody, right? I'm not going to let the cops arrest you. I'm not going to tell your wife, none of that stuff. So she's still playing a little bit of that game. It's just, she's leaning more toward the future here.
Yeah. And if Ed hadn't come in with the Mars offer, who knows? Because she's not saying you can't go to Mars. She's saying you need to take yourself off flight status and work your way back into the air. And then maybe, I mean, right, I don't know. Right. With this compressed schedule, he probably understands that accepting this is all but taking me off of the mission for sure. But
I think so. And I'm trying to figure out, so this scene with Danielle where she tells him all that stuff and takes him off the Mars mission, I'm trying to figure out how much of this is Danny sort of getting sick of the special treatment that he's getting because of his hero parents. But there's also this other thing in the mix, right, which is Karen. And he's not getting the one thing that he wants, so that's probably extra frustrating. It's like, oh, I can live my life with no consequences elsewhere, but I can't get this other thing that I want. And so my hero status only goes so far, right?
Yeah.
It's got to be also.
Like I said, there's multiple layers of shit that this kid's going through, any one of which would be, like I said, I don't feel much sympathy for Danny, but like it's definitely there because, boy, you look at the way he was, you know, raised, and you look at the what's happened to his parents and what happened to him in his space program, and it's tough. It's tough.
All right. Aleda's husband is disappointed she didn't talk with him before she turned down the Helios offer, and they argue about that, and it eventually turns into a conversation about her father's deteriorating mental health, and she's very much in denial. She doesn't want to hear it.
We've seen this scene so many times with the man that has a busy career, blowing off his wife's concerns about the kids and about the old man and about the parents and a living situation. It's interesting to see it from the other because it's the exact same conversation.
Yeah.
You know,
no, I loved some of the gender reversal, role reversal mm-hmm. stuff they're doing. Like with Molly, they did a lot of that stuff too. And yep. her husband.
They're also doing a little bit of, you know, we are not from this country. We're not white people. We don't do the thing where we dump our old folks off at homes and we don't let other people raise our kids. And he's like, mm-hmm. it's easy for you to say because you're not here. And mm-hmm. then when she says, I thought it's completely unconvincing when she says, I've never seen anything like my dad, when we know that's a lie.
Right.
But him, instead of attacking that, just being like, well, maybe it's because you're not around. Because there's some scary yeah. shit. Him wandering off with the kid and getting lost on the way back. Bad things can happen there. Leaving burners on. Getting into maybe potential fights with the neighbors because he's getting paranoid about them. Like, these are bad things for an elderly person with dementia. And probably is going to need full-time care sooner rather than later. And I'm wondering, because it feels like all this is going to boil over in the middle of the Mars mission, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally. I mean, they're setting up for a massive meltdown in one respect or another with Danny and Ed and Karen all in the mix.
Yeah. Yep.
Speaking of Ed, Danielle tells him that hiring Danny is a mistake. Ed doesn't agree, and he decides to announce the newest team member to the rest of the team.
Well, I think we skipped over a bunch of things. We skipped over seeing Danny and his wife.
Yeah, Amber preparing a meal when Danny comes home. And he's going to tell her about what happened and losing his job and all that. But before he does, Ed calls, offers him a job on the flight crew of the Phoenix. And then we get the scene where Danielle says, that's a bad idea.
Do you get it? To me, I got a clear picture of why Danny likes Amber. She seems like Karen 2.0. She's like in the middle of the 90s. Okay. She is that uh-huh. classic 1950s housewife who is just homemaking. She is setting a table for her man. She's got a roast in the oven that's timed for when he gets home from work. She's wearing her apron. I mean, it's like fucking Betty Draper, season one Betty Draper. It's amazing. Yeah. And that is who Karen was when he's growing up, and he is just trying to remake this mommy figure for himself.
Mm-hmm. Also, have I mentioned how gorgeous everyone in this show is to a person? Because Amber, geez, come on.
Except for Danny. Danny might be a perfectly fine guy, but the way they got him made, he's a little American Psycho.
Okay.
I think it's all acting. Yeah. A little like he's just like wound a little tight or maybe backwards and wrong. I don't know. It's little like what if Joffrey had grown up like kind of little Homelander and the dead eyes. I don't know. There's all kinds of like flashing red lights in this kid's what's going on in this kid's head, man. And it's coming out on the face.
Here's the thing that I don't understand about Danny. Why is he willing to go to another planet with the man whose ex-wife he is in love with and slept with while they were married. That is a recipe for disaster, kid.
You can tell he thinks it's like, here's the thing that's so frustrating is he's about to do the right thing, the scary thing, and take Danielle's advice and level with his wife. Maybe not tell her the whole truth, but come forward about like what's happening with me and NASA and what and how this is the same as when I got in the wreck and all this other stuff. And then Ed calls and is like, yeah, damn shame about the way NASA treats his employees. Why don't you? And leans really heavily on the let's get the Baldwin Stevens band back together. Just be like a Paul. And on Danny's face, you can see that this is all a bad idea. And he's seeing the like, oh, God, I'm going to be cooped up with Karen's ex-husband. And maybe they've gotten back together. But then he looks at his wife and she's just like ready to worship this guy. And you know, the relief that the Mars thing's back on is palpable with him.
Yeah, he gives him an out, right?
Right, right.
And Danny's willing to take that because he's kind of looking for it.
One of the big, I think, potential losses, of course, I haven't seen episode 4, even though we have advanced copies, we're watching them along with you. Like, you know, we're not watching ahead of our recording. One of the potential losses of the 2-year time jump is I would love to see what Danny was like in the program. I would love to see like how him and Ed as his commanding officer got along.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not going to see any of that.
No.
It doesn't seem like there's any bad blood when they're taken off to Mars. Like Ed seems very satisfied with himself. But like, how did this kid get it together? Or was it really drunken, sloshy Gordo Ed behavior that, or I guess Ed or Gordo. Gordo was always the one that was more of the wild man. And Ed just is like so quick to plug Danny into his Gordo slot that he just excuses it all and sees it as normal.
Yeah. Yeah, it's wild. But like I said, I think it's all going to spin apart eventually for drama's sake.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, we go to the IAC convention, 1992's IAC convention, where IS is getting all the attention, which Margo and Sergey are not super happy about. Margo invites Sergey up to her room for a nightcap, and things get physical at her very specific request, but Sergey can't go through with it, turns out. He says the problem is work, and he needs her to give him some of NASA's technology again, this time the engine design, which is nuclear, which will definitely be used as a weapon. So she refuses. Sergey apologizes, and then somebody knocks on her door.
Ominous knocking.
You know what's weird in this room? Is Margo one of those freaks who goes to a convention, unpacks her suitcase into the drawers for a weekend trip? Do you know anybody who fully unpacks and puts away everything? Because this room is spotless. There's no clothes. There's no nothing. Is this because she knew?
I prefer to do that.
What?
I prefer. What? Unless it's an overnight trip, like I'm just sleeping. Like I do like to get my shit out and put it into the drawers and put stuff away.
Yeah. All right. Maybe this is like a 4 or 5 day conference. Then maybe. But come on, a weekend.
Or maybe I'm just a freak like Margo. I'm a jazz playing, clothes unpacking, suitcase tidying freak.
Right? Yeah. What do you think of this scene?
I like how she takes the bull by the horns and she's like, I'm not taking any chances. I'm inviting this man up to my room with a bottle of alcohol and things are going to happen. And when he's balking and kind of like, you know, I'm going to stand up and demand him kiss me. And I was actually impressed because this man showed a complete lack of game to get here. But it was a surprisingly, I think it's exactly what Margo was wanting from a seduction by her Russian suitor.
You can have your seduction fast,
I thought,
effective, right. what's the third one here?
Containing compromise.
sure. But you can only pick two, right?
Yeah, pick two. And the thing is, so then I started realizing, well, the guy's lack of game is probably because he's kind of going this half-hearted. Like he wants it, sure, but he knows this is going to further complicate things with her, and that this is going to.
Yeah.
You know, even probably more than he even knew. Like, I don't know if he knew he's going to get choked up, you know.
I think he has an idea. The way
erotic asphyxiation kind of way.
Right.
But
And the way he tells her, like, look, there are enormous pressures on me, right? I think he knows. He's fully aware of the consequences if this doesn't work out.
Well, and I like how he starts off collegially and like kind of like, you know, be like, I've got, you know, you really helped me out to like, he's essentially begging and pleading. And then when that fails, the ominous knock.
Yep.
And
you realize, oh shit, they had this bugged,
you
right?
Knew.
Yeah.
You could hear the spring trap finally swing shut.
Yep. That's a great scene. Then we go over to Kelly meeting with her parents at the outpost for their spaghetti dinner. That's back, baby. They invite her out to Helios, but she says, I've decided to take the job at NASA. Her parents are obviously disappointed for themselves, but happy for her. And I love Ed putting Parmesan on his spaghetti. Holy
dude,
shit.
I did. Same cheese, freeze-dried shit. He takes the lid off so he can dump the maximum amount. He's not going to sit there and shake it for 60 seconds. He's going to dump.
And Karen notices, too. She's just like, oh, my God, he's still doing that.
Isn't it interesting how this felt like the old Outpost? Like, it's almost like, yeah, I mean, sure, the Outpost has been Chuck E. Cheese-ified, but, like, you get the right amount of people and the right spirit. It really makes me think better about my observation that Ed's not wanting to say hi, Bob, was less about this still feeling like the old Outpost and more about his personal feelings about what had just happened to him.
Yeah.
And kind of being shitty to Danielle, although Dan saying it for her perspective, she seems like she's trying to put all this behind her. We haven't talked about it, but this whole episode, she's made several statements about, oh, you know, when Kelly was there, it's like, oh, me and your dad will be fine. We've been through a lot. It's like, you know, we'll, I don't know about that. Especially as the race really heats up.
Yeah. We'll see how they interact on Mars.
Ed has a maniacal gear that I don't think that Danielle has necessarily. And that's not a compliment. It's
right.
It's just, so
yeah. I mean, the guy who was ready to fire weapons at the Soviets, spacecraft last season. And the woman who refused an order to stand down so she could shake
a Russian's hand. Right? Yeah.
They're pretty diametrically opposed as far as their world.
They get to the same result. They just came from completely different paths to get there.
Yeah.
I love this. I like Kelly, you know, you can tell that she had her dad's like anger and stubbornness in mind because she's kind of steeling herself to deal with that, but saying like, look, I love to fly. Mm-hmm. I love flying with you. I love flying because of you. You've given me all these things. But I also love NASA and I need to step out and spread my own wings to fly. And him, you know, the way he handled it, because like, I think he's even being sly. He knew what to think. And like, instead of like dressing her down, he's going to show her the ultimate respect of looking her in the eye and being like, this, our country's going to be real proud of you, kid. I got choked up. I thought that was Ed learning things in a positive way rather than negatively, as we've seen throughout this episode.
For sure. All right. Soviets sit down with Margo and pressure her to give up the NASA engine design. They threaten her with being labeled a spy, which doesn't work. So then they threaten to kill Sergey and tell her to think about it, giving her a card with a number to call when she makes up her mind. The next morning, Margo heads back to NASA where she gets right back to work.
Yeah, this is they reference the Sergey Korolev, who is kind of like the Russian Wernher von Braun. The father of their rocket program. And apparently what they're saying is like early in his career, pre-World War II, he got caught up in some kind of political scandal and got sent to the Gulag where he suffered terrible health problems, ended up missing half of his teeth, sustained damage that would later cause him to have a heart attack in the middle of the moon race. And one of the things that probably caused the Russians to fall behind because there was like a talented engineer right underneath him ready to take over, but he instantly got into a pissing match with the other guy who kind of hated this Korolev all of his life. It's interesting because like I read it and it's like this Russian's using this as an example of like the way that Russia can break people no matter what, because if you don't have principles, they'll take advantage of that. If you have principles, they'll take advantage of your loved ones and apply pressure. But ultimately, it's self-defeating because they killed their von Braun in like his middle, like his late 50s, early 60s. And it was all problems based on his brutal treatment that he got in the gulag. In fact, that they tried to intubate him to save his life at the last on the operating table, and his jaw was so fucked up from all the abuse he'd taken, they couldn't intubate him fast enough, and he essentially drowned in his own blood.
Jeez.
It's like I said, it's one of the things where I think it works without knowing all the references, but it's also kind of ominous from a Russian perspective that they're trying to, get ahead in this way.
Gotcha. Yeah. The thing I took out of it is, look, we're willing to torture our heroes this way. What do you think we'll do to a foreigner?
This is also true. However, Margo touches down in the United States. The first thing she does is go to the first thing she should have done is go to the director of the FBI and confess.
Yeah.
She's in a Roman Catholic booth and just tell everything that's happened because.
Mm-hmm. And then she can be the counteroperative, right? That's the thing. They can try and turn Sergey and make maybe twist this to their advantage, and she can cut a deal with him.
But going down this path, Sergey's going to die no matter what. I there's no fucking way. And she might end her career in disgrace because I think she's right. These Russians had nothing on her. She's I've done nothing mm-hmm. but to help in the further humanity's thing in the flight. And I haven't done this and I haven't done that. And they only have Sergey they can use against her. And I understand if you're in that position, but man, it just never seems like succumbing to blackmail is the way to go.
Right.
It's just at best delaying the inevitable and mm-hmm. most times making the inevitable far, far worse. But,
I agree.
And they leave it ambiguous because we flash forward 2 years and we don't know exactly what happens. But any guesses?
I don't know. I kind of wanted to talk about it in the final scene because we do get one last shot of her.
You're right.
Yeah, I mean, the best she could probably do here is control the message, okay, if I'm going to be outed for being a quote unquote spy, then let me at least control that message a little bit, and play it to my advantage as much as possible. But who knows what she does? She clearly doesn't go directly to the FBI. She goes directly to work.
And she's just so cool. This whole scene, she could have an ice cube in her mouth that would not have melted. Cause even when they're garroting Sergey, she's kind of hey, stop. Jesus, stop. Mm-hmm. This is a lot. But she's not hysterical or overcome with emotion. She's just really cool as a cucumber, man.
And when she gets back to work, I couldn't tell a difference in her demeanor.
No.
I don't think anyone could.
Maybe, I guess, because the next scene is the scene with Bill.
Uh-huh.
Do we want to?
Yeah, so Bill is waiting in her office when she gets back admiring her pictures. He tells her, I'm going to take the job at Helios that I was offered. Margo only says goodbye to him after he leaves the office, says goodbye to the air. And then she considers the Russian proposition.
Yeah. For Captain Piss Pants, Peanut, PP, this is a really good exit. He's trying to do the right thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And who can blame him? He's devoted most of his life to NASA. And we'll get to the other side of this with Elaida. But how much of this is Margo just being Margo, and how much of this is her being preoccupied with the Russian defection kind of business? Because I could see her pulling this even if she had come back from the IAC conference freshly laid, with new comradeship. Because she's kind of. I just could see her doing it. She's that type of person.
Sure. Yeah. I don't think this is out of the ordinary for her.
Yeah.
Then Bill packs up his office as he tells Elaida how life affirming the Helios job offer was for him personally. Tells Elaida she'll be a great flight director and then says goodbye to her. And there is so much backstory in this relationship. Similar to what he talks about with the Margo hazing, right? He kind of hazed her when she showed up for the first time and he was shitty to her.
And she was shitty back, a disproportionate response kind of way.
And that was one of my favorite scenes last season, is them coming to terms with each other, and getting over that and getting on the same page. And yeah, it feels real good, real fuzzy here in this scene.
Yeah. I liked it. And like the fact I really appreciated Bill, like, you know, wanting to feel like I feel like an old shoe. I feel like a new shoe. Like Karen said, I'm a git. She listed all my accomplishments and she called me a git. Like that probably more than anything is what motivates Bill. Like the fact that he feels like he's like the Harambe, esprit de corps that he got over there. And like the fact that, I don't know, Karen also feels like a person that knows exactly what to say to get the people she needs. And the only one she's really failed at so far is, well, I guess Kelly, but Aleda.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that she calls him Peanut at the end and there's no heat behind it. It's just affection. And then they're trash talking. Like almost every one of these goodbyes ends in trash talking, which again, this has got to be foreshadowing the real heat that's going to come later in the season.
Yeah. And I thought they were foreshadowing even more, but I'm not so sure. So Aleda works late at her job while Soundgarden plays us out to a mostly empty mission control. And I thought this was going to be the end of the episode. I thought they were saying, look, they've poached so much of NASA's talent. Yep. How are they ever going to get to Mars in 1994? But then the episode doesn't end, and 2 years later in 1994 all three Mars missions are launching simultaneously. The now US president Ellen calls Margot to congratulate her on a successful launch and encourage her to kick the other mission's asses. That's the end of the episode,
and it's like a knife twister. You should be proud. We've been working together for this a long time, and I'm assuming Margot has compromised with the Russians and given them the
Or she could be regretting letting Sergei die. It's tough to tell in her expression, right? Because she is like that.
So
ice
the Russians
cube,
were able to get the Russians were able to kill off Sergei and still get the space with the working fusion drive.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That's where I think it's like I don't see how both of those things happen.
You're right. Oh, Margo, what do you do?
Unless Margo did the thing where she's going to be a double agent. That would be super interesting, too.
Yes.
And they're keeping us. They're keeping it from us.
But boy, would the Americans be willing to risk giving the Soviets nuclear technology, nuclear secrets in order to keep her as a double agent?
Is there a chance that there'll be some space piracy? Like the Russians know they can't catch, but like if they get at the right time, the right launch window, they can like catch up to one of these and like commandeer it.
Oh Jesus! So they like,
they're gonna go for unsustained burn. Like they're gonna like use up all their propellant just to catch one of these and take it over by force. Space piracy.
Maybe. I mean, they all launch at the exact same time.
Yeah,
I suppose it's possible.
I don't think there's a very good chance of that happening. It would be a super interesting thing. It'd be a third path between the ones we've been presenting.
For sure.
Boy, it's exciting to see all three of these things launch off. You got the Battlestar Galactica approach. You got the Zubrin's like small crew capsule catching up to all the stuff that's already there on Mars. And then you've got the Soviets fucking giant rocket, single stage, looking like something from the Cosmodrome and Destiny, the game. What a cool looking rocket, man. I think the Russian rockets are so cool.
Oh, yeah,
cool
the
looking.
Russians. All right.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know, there's something about them that look a little bit more Art Deco futuristic than, you know, NASA's big, just regular old stack.
Yeah. I mean, I do really love the 2001-esque look of the Helios platform, but I could see it. Yeah, I'm really interested to see what kind of tech we have on Mars, because I've seen a little bit of it in the trailer, and I assume that, you know, NASA is going to have upgraded tech, but also ISS is going to have probably some of the best tech on Mars, right?
Best of breed. Like, it might not be cutting edge, like something maybe that this, like, I don't think he's got a nuclear engine. He's got these big you know, methane rockets, but yeah, whatever he's got commercially available.
Oh, really? Because I thought he had developed a lot of fusion technology.
Oh, I guess that's true.
Right, he's using fusion engines.
I guess
he could adapt
that. Huh? He talks about his pioneering methane rockets, though.
Are those for mining methane? Or no, that's helium.
Maybe
I don't know.
Yeah, because like, I was like, if he had the nuclear reactor, I don't know why you'd fuck around with those massive engines with these massive propellant things. You'd do the NASA approach and just have a... Because that's the thing. Yeah. Like, Danny's incredible. It's like, it's just like a little VTOL craft that takes off. Like, how many crew do you think is on a NASA mission?
A handful? Like, maybe a dozen? I don't know.
I was thinking a dozen. Probably something more like 6 or 7 compared to, like, I think they said the Helios is planning on taking 24.
Yep.
And who the hell knows what the Russian's going to take?
Yeah. I wonder if the war for Mars is going to be won with manpower. You know,
I like that they continue to treat the Russians as they're like a black box. You have no idea what their shit's going to look like, how it's going to behave until you actually get there and start coming into contact with them, because we just have no visibility into them.
They just sent monkeys.
A little bit.
There are no humans on their ships.
Russian monkeys. No, I do like that, because like we got a little bit last year with Sergei, but like we still didn't get a lot, and they're very mysterious. Like, that's a big ass rocket. What do they've got on Mars now? Mm-hmm. What are they going to do? Are they going to engage in space piracy? We'll see.
The other big questions, you know, is how Danny ever made it through mission prep with Karen and Ed in very close proximity the entire time.
Dude,
we skip all that, like you said, but maybe for the best. Who knows?
Maybe Karen's just fucking him for the mission.
Sure. Yeah.
Why not?
They got their own room on the old Polaris, and one of the mobile habs just set up with a red light, a sex swing. Yeah. Sure.
What do you need a sex swing? You can go up to the hub and do 0G.
That's true. You wouldn't need a sex swing.
Windows
in space.
To the wall stuff,
you need sex,
man.
Anchors in space, honestly.
You do. You need sex Velcro. something to get some purchase, some mag boots. You need mm-hmm. can't take your mag boots off. You gotta keep your mag boots on when you're having sex in space.
That's it for the episode. Any other thoughts before we get out of here?
I'm curious about, I would like to know more about the practicality of the Phoenix, because mm-hmm. that spinning ring is not doing much when they are thrusting towards Mars. Like, nope. Are they going to do like
could
one
still
big
give you
impulse?
Gravity though, that, you know,
it could, but it's a different type of spin gravity, you know, than spin gravity. So, and I don't think they have enough repel. So like, are they going to do like one big impulse and then kind of coast to Mars and then do, and you know, like, what does the hab ring transition between those two periods of time? Like, how does that work? And probably won't get those details, but I was curious about how this, because man, I'm with you, that Phoenix thing looks fucking cool. Mm-hmm. It looks exactly like the spaceship I thought we'd have by 2020.
Yeah,
you know, that will do it for this week's episode. We recorded, I think, episode 2 and 3 in advance, which means we don't have any feedback to go off of. So we probably will have just a mega alpha and omega feedback episode when we get back to recording, which will be the week of the June 27th. So if you don't hear any feedback, don't get antsy. It's just we're going to have a big old buildup of it when we get back. But please keep sending it. We got a lot so far. People seem to be jazzed about the new episodes, the new mission. FAM, FAM, stands, of course, for All Mankind, at Bald Move. FAM, FAM, at baldmove.com is how you send us feedback. And I am really looking forward to plowing into it when we get back. But until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
We'll see you next week.